Campus FM presents a talk organized by the Faculty of Theology entitled Bioethics and the Normative Concept of Human Personhood. This talk is delivered by Professor Ludger Hohenfelder from the University of Berlin.
The beginning of human life has always been a mystery which challenged not only philosophers to explain since Aristotle's time, to explain in the background of the biological knowledge of their own times. It challenged not only philosophy but also theology. The thorny issue of the beginning of human life has become, as you all know, more crucial and more at the forefront of the bioethical debate, particularly with the birth of Louise Brown, with reproductive technologies, when human life, we know that human life does not begin only in vivo, but now in vitro. So we have human life at our disposal in a petri dish in laboratories. Since then, in the late 80s, the birth of Louise Brown, today with the challenge of regenerative medicine and stem cell research, the issue of the moral status of the human embryo has become the central problem in bioethics. For this lecture, we have the pleasure again to hear Professor Hohenfelder, who will be speaking on the bioethics and the normative concept of the human being, what is the nature and the status of the human embryo. This is the question usually raised: what and who is the embryo? When does human life begin? What status should we give to the human embryo, which has an impact on the crucial problems, particularly dealing with regenerative medicine, as we heard yesterday, with stem cell research. Professor Hohenfelder.
Thank you very much for the invitation to speak about this important question of bioethics, and for the welcome by my colleague and friend, Professor Agus. My point of departure is this one: to answer the question what nature and status a human embryo, and particularly a human embryo in vitro, have, it is necessary to clarify what nature and status the human being in general have. And as moral status, I will understand the claim of respect and protection something will have, what we consider as a good, or to say it in short, the status of a moral and a pre-moral good. And some remarks for introduction, and then I will take two approaches, and for answering as my fourth point the question regarding the embryos, and to finish with an outlook. When we want to answer the already mentioned questions, we have the possibility to depart from two different approaches. The first one I want to say, call the ontological or value-oriented approach, and the second one you could call a practical and person-oriented approach. The first one you can connect with the names of Aristotle or with modern analytical philosophy, and the second one you can connect with Descartes, Kant, or John Locke. And the first approach will start with our use of a concept. It starts from a you could call it ontological or metaphysical description of the nature of the human being and connected with a particular value statement about that nature from which the status of the embryo can be determined. Usually we do not have doubts about what we mean when we describe someone as a human being. We mean an individual human living being and have no hesitation in describing all members of our species as such. And if we examined the way in which we attribute the predicate of human being to someone, there can be no doubt that we use it as a subtle term, as the recent analytical philosophy calls it. This means a general term by which we simultaneously identify and describe something. And it is a characteristic of such terms that they function, as Kripke and Putnam calls it, they function as rigid designators, as designators of a natural species of a particular nature. And they are, in a hidden way, indexical. Indexical means that they refer to something existing in reality in the form of a natural species. What determines such a species is not a matter of linguistic convention, but of reality and the natural laws which characterizes. And according to this type of concept or term, the subtle term human being means an individual of a natural species characterized by particular features, which we may call the nature, which characterize all specimens of that species. And the natural species designated by the expression human being is a living being whose nature includes the ability to perform both physical functions, such as walking or standing, and mental ones, such as being self-conscious or acting rationally and freely. And according to the British philosopher Peter Strawson, it is characteristic of the natural species human being that both M means material predicates and P, personal predicates, physical and mental predicates, can be applied to an individual of the species human being simultaneous and indifferently. And it is a further characteristic of subtle terms such as human being that they denote qualities which an entity does not possess in addition to the fact of existence, but which are characteristic of their very manner of existing. A human being exists as a living being with the faculty of reason, or not at all. Being a rational living being is the manner of his existence, which is why, if a human being is no longer such a being, we say that he or she no longer exists. That is why we call someone who is prevented from using his reason a sick human being, and one who has not yet been born and achieved the use of reason, we call it an unborn human being and do not call them something different. Finally, it is characteristic of the term human being that by an individual whom we so designate, we mean an individual who remains one and the same through time and space. It is not only one that exists here and now, but an entity that persists over a particular stretch of time and space, And if it were not possible to assume that by human beings we mean individuals of a natural species about whom we can make both M and P statements according to Strawson, and who are persisting entities, as it can be called in the terminology of analytical philosophy, then we would not be able to re-identify ourselves and others in time and space, nor to describe other members of the species Homo sapiens as human beings, nor to speak meaningfully of human rights. And what modern philosophy describes using these subtle terms and their specific manner of being predicated, already Aristotle had in mind when he speaks of ousia, or in Latin, substance. And this consensus regarding the term human being, no, I will come to this later. And with this use of the subtle term human being, a fundamental value statement is connected. What we mean when we predicate human being, according to my thesis, we understand it in sort of a preferential judgment as a good, in a non-moral sense, insofar as it represents the object of a value judgment which serves as the basis of our moral action-related judgments. To regard the human being as a good that we place above all other goods is in this sense a value judgment in the form what we can call an ultimate practical judgment on which all agree. In doing so, we do not confine ourselves to features described by biological taxonomy, but attribute to human beings, unlike all other living beings, an absolute value, because human beings are living beings whose nature is to have the faculty of reason, to be able to relate to themselves and pursue goals of their own choice. And the human right theorist Dworkin expresses it with the sentence, I quote, "Almost everyone shares explicitly or intuitively the idea that human life has objective, intrinsic value that is quite independent of its personal value for everyone." If the human being has absolute value, then according to this ontological and value-oriented interpretation, the unborn human being will be covered by both statements, by the subtle predicate and the value statement. If human being denotes a natural species, part of whose nature it is to begin his life as the living being it is at one particular point in time and to end it at another, then the predicate human being and the value statement attributed to that being apply from the beginning of human life and death, from the beginning of human life until death. Since the expression human being is in a hidden way indexical, it as denotes a natural species, the question is in what the life of individuals of this species consists, from when to when that life lasts, and which individuals belong to this species, and this is not a question to this first approach, is not a question of linguistic convention or an attribution of value, but a question of what reality is involved here. It is a question of natural laws as they are investigated by empirical sciences. And therefore we can conclude that it is without an advantage of this first approach that it speaks exclusively of the human being as so designated, and the value judgment refers to nothing else and rests on nothing else but being human. If it can be shown that this view of the nature and the status of the human being precedes all other differentiation and is justified independently of any reference to the status of a person, to rights, to duties, or other additional assumptions, then the distinction between being a human being and being a person in relation to the question of the nature and status of the embryo is not only superfluous, but perfectly irrelevant. This approach of speaking only of the human being and nothing else, and of attributing absolute value to human life independent of all other qualities, is the very foundation, I think, of the idea of human dignity and human rights, which has gained recognition meanwhile throughout all cultures and religions. And now we are coming to the second approach, which you could call the practical or person-oriented approach. And this approach is based on the assumption that when, in a moral or legal context, we describe the human being as a person, in so doing we attribute to them a particular moral status which we could call the status of dignity. According to the German philosopher Kant, dignity is an attribute of a good which cannot be weighed up against other goods because it possesses not a relative value which can be measured against others, but an inner absolute value. And according to this approach, the status of a person attaches to such beings as are by nature capable of being the reason for their own action, setting and pursuing their own goals, in short, of being responsible moral subjects. And if the possibility of setting and pursuing goals is a prerequisite of all moral action and any moral requirement, the moral subject must regard it, as Kant expressed it, as an end in itself, and absolute value must be ascribed to the person. And adopting a moral attitude accordingly means, as a prior consideration before any individual requirements, recognizing the human being as a person, it as someone and not as something, and ascribing absolute value to it. And it's important to note that the status of a person is not the result, but the object of mutual recognition. Dignity is not ascribed to the person on the basis of particular qualities, achievements, or social relations, but regarded, so far Kant, as a value indissolubly bound up with the person. There's no doubt that the term person refers to the human being as moral subject, yet it does not thereby denote something distinct from human being. Rather, it designates the human being in its nature of a rational subject. As already explained, rationality is not an attribute which a human being may or may not possess, but a part of that which defines human nature. If human beings are and do not have their nature, and being a person means possessing the faculty of reason or the ability to be a subject, then the term person means the same as the term human being, that is to say, every individual of the natural species, human being. And that's the position of Kant. He has no difficulty to ascribe dignity to man insofar as he is capable of being a moral subject, and in so ascribing to all stages of human development. I quote Kant, "For what is thus produced is a person, and it is impossible to think of a being endowed with personal freedom as produced merely by a physical process. And hence, in the practical relation, it is quite a correct and even a necessary idea to regard the act of generation as a process by which a person is brought without his consent into the world and placed in it by the responsible free will of others." End of quotation. Kant has difficulties with the concept of substance in theoretical philosophy, but he stresses and emphasizes that we do need the concept of substance as a persisting entity in practical philosophy, because otherwise we couldn't identify human beings as subjects of their actions through space and time. But there are other positions, and these other positions play a strong role in the recent debate, and this is the distinction between person and human being, which goes back to John Locke. Only such human beings are regarded as persons or as bearer of rights when they have interests or preferences of interests. That moral status should begin only where present qualities exist, which are required in order to be able to pursue interests and preference, can hold good, according to this approach, only if being a person is not characterized by the continuing existence of human living being in time and space, but if the beginning and the end of the person is determined, and that's the position of John Locke, by the continuity of consciousness. This is only possible if we share Locke's nominalistic doubts about the reality of a natural species and the persistence of individuals, and consequently understand the continuing consciousness in the form of, and we understand the continuing identity of human being in time and space as a mental combination of states of consciousness in the form of the memory. The personal identity is the consciousness by memory. And this assumption can withstand the question, who is the bearer of that consciousness, only if we replace the ontology based on persistent objects which underlie the mode of application of the predicate human being in the world we live in. And this is outlined by an ontology based on event and is suggested by the British philosopher Derek Parfitts, and his position is that identity is a chain of events, a mental connectedness, according this Lockean position. And he emphasizes that he does not need this deep further fact as he called it, which consists in the assumption of a persisting entity like a substance. But on the other hand, his ontology of mental connectedness, for my opinion, needs much deeper presuppositions than this ontology behind the use of social terms, an ontology of events must be based in a four-dimensional ontology and makes a lot of presuppositions and is not more convincing than the ontology of the first approach. And the assumption of Locke and Parfit contradicts our own practical self-interpretation. And David Wiggins and others have emphasized this point. Our concern is not to add another phase to the already existing phases of our existence, but to survive as the being which we are. The concern for our own lives is a concern not only to ensure that further phases of our lives are added to the existing ones, but that we continue to exist in the future as what we are. If human beings are entitled to the status of person insofar as they are human beings, then this status must be ascribed to them for the duration of their existence as such. Even an unborn human being, this follows from the first approach, has the status of a person because it is a living human being which carries within it all the potential to develop the manner of living which is characteristic of individuals of the natural species, human being. But the question is, how can this conclusion be defended against the objection that this notion of potential is too vague because it applies equally to ovum at sperm cell before they unite, and that it does not follow from the fact that the embryo is to become a person that is already a person in its present state? And that my next point, what arguments can be used if we want to extend the assumptions about the nature and the status of the human being in its adult shape to the unborn human being, and particularly to the human embryo vitro? And the three criteria which are mostly used to argue for this extensions are the potentiality, the identity, and the continuity. Regarding potentiality and answering the objections, it is important to distinguish between a mere possibility, for instance, the possibility of an unfertilized egg to become fertilized, or the actual capability, the capability of a fertilized egg to develop to an adult human being, ceteris paribus, under the normal conditions, by its own causality. And there has been a discussion how the concept of potentiality has to be understood, and we can discuss this more in detail later. I would like to quote Aristotle, For what each thing is when fully developed, we call its nature, whether we are speaking of a man or a horse. The second argument, and if it is correct that the fertilized egg has the actual capability to develop to an adult human being, then a strong argument is used that the unborn human being is an individual of the same species and participating in the same predicate and the same value statement as the born human being. And there you have this Aristotle quotation. The second criterion is that one of continuity, and if we would like to follow Locke or Parfit, then continuity has to be understood as a mental connectedness. We could call it with analytical philosophy as a sort of ontological endurantism. And the strong argument that continuity regarding human beings means that they have a diachronic unity in form of an ontological persistence, as called perdurantism. One of the strong arguments is the human self-interpretation. We are describing ourselves by sentences like, I was born at such and such time, and we see ourselves as the child of particular parents, tracing our identity back to the time when the child began as a living being conceived by those parents. If, however, the question, who am I, cannot be answered without answering the question, where I come from and where do I want to go, then it is possible to explain why our concern to survive cannot be understood as the wish to add to the conscious phases of our life, but as the wish to continue to live as who we are. If concern for survival is always concern for identity, then it becomes understandable that our concern to survive also includes the concern or interest in not having been killed at an earlier point in time. That's important. The viewpoint of interests is not restricted to the conscious phases of a human being, because our interest is not to be killed before. And that's a strong argument regarding the diachronic unity. I think we are confronted with a ontological choice. Do we want to see the world from a scientific viewpoint? And this is the restricted viewpoint of event causality. Science explains events by chains of events which can be described by laws, by regular connections. Or do we prefer to take the viewpoint of agent causality? And agent causality is this sort of self-understanding as agent subjects. And I think that the viewpoint of agent causality is the more comprehensive and the more basic one. the viewpoint of event causality is a more restricted one, a conditioned one. It's the viewpoint from science, but not what we could call in German the Lebenswelt, the viewpoint from the acting human being. And therefore, in both cases, we are confronted with ontological implications, and it seems to me that there are strong arguments regarding the priority of agent causality and regarding the first approach. The last criterion is that of identity, and here we are confronted with the question, what is the relation between personal identity and individuality? And the objection is that after fertilization, after complete fertilization, a multiplication of human being by twinning is possible, and therefore some argue that we have a pre-individual stage followed by the individual stage at the end of the possibility to be multiplicated by division in the on the embryological level, and the counter argument to this point that we have a pre-embryo stage or a pre-individual stage and then followed by an individual stage when the primitive streak is formed and other criteria are realized. The counter-argument is that there's no stage after complete fertilization in which the entity which we, with which we are confronted is not individual in a genetic sense and in an ontological sense. Therefore, we have to explain the possibility of multiplication, of twinning, by in another way. Since without division, the development that begins with fertilization comprises stages but no interruptions to break the continuity, beginning with the fusion of the two sets of chromosomes, genetic uniqueness is inseparable from numerical individuality. And in the event of multiplication, once or more additional individuals are formed from the one individual previously existing individual, there's no stage at which genetic uniqueness is not linked to individuality. To come to an end and to have time for a discussion, I would like to conclude with the statement that the absolute value which we ascribe to human beings under the term dignity is founded, as far as I can see, according to the ethical and legal consensus expressed in the notion of human dignity and human rights, on no other circumstance but that of being human. It is recognized not on grounds of particular achievements or qualities, but by virtue of the recognition due to every human being. So far, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Hohnefelder, not only for today's lecture, but by honoring us to hold these three lectures in honor of St. Thomas Aquinas on Tuesday, yesterday and today, one on the potent role St. Albert the Great played in the formation and the the philosophical theological approach of Thomas Aquinas, the patron saint of our faculty, and yesterday and today's lecture on bioethics. The two themes you have touched upon are quite crucial. I hope that this is not your last visit. Hopefully you will come again, because you haven't seen a lot from Malta. We kept you busy, practically a lecture every day, and I'm sure that you can share a lot of other philosophical and theological aspects from your research. I would like also to take the opportunity to thank the students, particularly the committee of the Theology Student Association, for cooperating with the Faculty of Theology in organizing this. Practically, you have been responsible for this with our cooperation. We thank you very much for that, and we thank you also for your presence. Thank you.
And I have to thank all the responsibles for this wonderful stay at Malta.
Thank you.
You have just listened to a talk organized by the Faculty of Theology entitled Bioethics and the Normative Concept of Human Personhood. This talk was delivered by Professor Ludger Hohnfelder from the University of Berlin.